Katrina and Haiyan. We'll have to embrace the glaciers are melting and the sea levels rising at a fast pace. People living on the coast are going to be displaced. Certain species extinct, less water to drink, other areas too wet, floods a big threat, other areas dry out, susceptible to drought, agriculture hit hard, coral reefs will be marred.
We have waited too long, act now, before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind, 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 the climate's on my mind.
Solar, wind, hydro, geothermal is the key. Those are kinds of renewable energy that we need to succeed and implement. 'Cause climate change is extremely significant. If you don't believe me.
You're listening to KWMR, Community Radio for West Marin, 90.5 FM in Point Reyes Station and 89.9 FM in Bolinas, and now 92.3 in the San Geronimo Valley, and streaming live on KWMR.org. So, welcome. We've called our program Post-Carbon Radio. Post-carbon to mean a transition to post-fossil fuels or post-petroleum future, where we power down using less energy, and a transition to renewable energy to reduce our carbon emissions that is causing global warming and catastrophic climate change. We believe in taking action to have a livable planet for future generations, building up our community resilience in the face of the crises we'll be facing, system change and not climate change. To change everything, we need everyone. So today our show is on the California drought. We have a pre-recorded interview with Brock Dolman, who is director of the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center's Water Institute. We'll also be talking about the Proposition 1, the California measure for water bonds. And we'll be talking to Chelsea Tu with the Center for Biological Diversity. So here's our interview with Brock Dolman.
Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Brock Dolman.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here and speak with you, Bean.
We're very delighted to have you because I know you have a lot of expertise looking at this crisis, this water crisis we're in now. Governor Brown declared a drought state of emergency in January and has directed state officials to take all necessary actions to prepare for water shortages. I was just reading that that the drought analysis shows California rangeland hardest hit. It says here in this report by a meteorologist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture that California topped the U.S. with 70% of its rangeland and pastures rated in very poor to poor conditions on September 28. Following California were Oregon, 47% very poor to poor, Nevada with 45%. Washington with 41%, New Mexico with 31%, and Texas with 31%. It sounds pretty dire, but you know the situation, I guess, also in California. So what we wanted to ask you, tell us a little bit more about your work with the Water Institute at the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center.
Sure, yeah. So the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center is a nonprofit in Western Sonoma County, and we have a number of programs, and one of them is the Water Institute, which is an acronym for Watershed Advocacy, Training, Education, and Research, and we also do restoration. And really, I think at some level, for those of us at the center, and as biologists, as ecologists, as people who are really interested in supporting human communities and the planetary life communities in holistic and healthy ways, we're really clear that no water, no life. And in fact, the interesting thing is that we don't really even perceive the place we live of as Planet Earth. We actually prefer to call it Planet Water because that's really much more actually descriptive and characteristic of this planet, being 70% of the surface area of the planet is covered in water. And with no water, no life, it's one of those things where we really get the clarity, if you will, that working on behalf of sustainability, which is about our ability to sustain the cycles of life, and specifically on this subject, the water cycle, the hydrologic cycle, is of paramount importance. And so how do we in our human communities do water-literate human settlements, whether that's rangeland or agriculture, forestry, urban, suburban, rural, manage our settlements in ways that support the quantity and quality of water and the integrity of the water cycle where we live. And then we ultimately really think about watersheds because that's really the geographic, topographical scale that we think is most efficacious to work within.
Great. So you teach about watersheds, water quality, and water conservation. What are the most common questions you get about water?
I think people often they want to, you know, people are interested about how can they make a difference, how can they help, how can they use less water, what watershed do they live in, or some don't even know what a watershed is, actually. Some folks want more water. They're trying to figure out how they can harvest more water, whether that's through roof water harvesting or through ponds or other solutions that might seem like one way to double your water budget at home is by installing gray water. So then you get a gallon of water used to wash your laundry, and then you can strategically use that same gallon out in your landscape to water a fruit tree. And all of a sudden, you just got 2 gallons worth of environmental service out of the same 1 gallon. So we just doubled our money, so to speak. So creative ways just to, you know, have a more integrated and holistic system. So people are often asking questions about how to do solutions-oriented, proactive things they can do in their life to support the quality of their life while they also aren't diminishing the quality of life for other life forms.
So, you know, we have a water catchment from our chicken coop roof. It's a large chicken coop, and we run pipes from the roof to a 2,500-gallon storage tank, and we use
Great.
That water to water our garden.
Which we used up pretty quickly this summer. It was kind of shocking. It sounds like a lot of water. Not a lot of water, really.
That's one of the things I think people ask me a lot about, and I think there's certain misconceptions in general, people's hydrological illiteracy, if you will, is just a sense about water demand and water quantity and how much water does one need in their life. And if you look at some of the statistics around the Bay Area, many of the urban areas, depending on how large people's landscape are often using upwards of 90, 110, 120 gallons a day per person for their water. And that's their indoor water use, bathrooms, showers,
wow.
You know, that kind of stuff, laundry, and also their outdoor water use, depending again on their landscape and if they have ornamentals or a lawn and that kind of stuff. And so when you think about 120 gallons a day per person in the Bay Area, and yet the World Health Organization estimates that at minimum what the planetary demand is from several billion people on this planet every day is in the range between 5 and 15 gallons.
Yeah.
A minimum of a quality of life. There's a big gap between that, and as this drought unfurls, we're all going to have to figure out how to balance our water budget, so to speak, and do more with less water, and also make sure that there's enough water for the environment and the streams and the fish and, you know, other non-human resources.
We live in the North Marin Water District, and they've imposed mandatory 25% cuts here where we live.
It's at 200 gallons per day per household is what they're asking us to limit ourselves to. And there's a penalty if you go over that of $2.50 per 1,000 gallons, which seems pretty modest to me, actually.
That seems modest. I know with the idea of tiered pricing and trying to figure out how to hit people in their pocketbook as an incentive to disincentive, if you will, using more water, but it does sound modest. The North Marin Water District, I know you all, a significant percentage, upwards of 75% at certain times of year, actually is water that comes to you from the Sonoma County Water Agency as a wholesaler, which comes out of the Russian River, of which a significant portion of that actually comes out of the Eel River watershed through the Potter Valley Project and Lake Pillsbury. And those systems are in dire straits up there in Potter Valley system and then on through Lake Mendocino and the Russian River. So you can see how North Marin, what's really supporting the consciousness of your water agency requesting you all to use less water. And that's kind of emblematic for community water supplies all over the state. Different agencies have different portfolios based on how they're managing their surface water, their reservoirs, their groundwater, their recycled wastewater, their conservation efforts. Some are certainly better than others, but there's no lack of dire stories in California right now of many communities that are on the edge of running out of water, and some have already run out and are drinking bottled water and having water delivered in trucks just to have daily needs met. And if the drought is real, it's serious. Like the rangeland data you mentioned in the very beginning of the show, it's really significant. We are leading the way in America right now with the intensity of the drought, and so it's intense.
Do you know the percentage of normal storage that Sonoma County has right now, where they are in terms of percentage of normal storage for this time of year?
I don't know those facts exactly. You know, Sonoma County gets a portion of its water supply for the Sonoma County Water Agency, not necessarily the county. The water agency gets water out of Lake Mendocino, which I don't know exactly, but I think it's down around the 40% full rate. And then there's Lake Sonoma out of the Warm Springs Dam system, which is a bigger system and has a bit more water in it. It's somewhere in, I think, the 60 to 70%. But I would, the listeners, don't quote me exactly on that. You could find that information online pretty quickly. But that water for Sonoma County is really part of what feeds the urban corridor, if you will. It's of the incorporated cities that come down from, whether it's Ukiah or Healdsburg or Windsor, Santa Rosa, Cotati, Rona Park, Petaluma, and then on to North Marin. And then actually at times of the year, upwards of 25% of that will make its way all the way down to the Marin Municipal Water District, all the way down to San Rafael and such. So, but then there's others of us who are rural residential people, and we are dependent on our own local water supply that falls on our land or in our local groundwater. So the population, about 600,000 apparently, get their water out of the Sonoma County Water Agency's wholesale system, but there's lots of us that don't. So the portfolio of anyone in Marin or Mendocino or Sonoma or whichever county you live in really depends on, again, what pipe shed are you connected to? Do you get it from a dam, or do you get it from the ground below your property, or a little bit of each, or from a local spring or a creek? And it's all very diverse.
I have in front of me a huge spread unfold from the National Geographic of the last issue. I don't know if you're aware that they had an article, a huge, comprehensive article. Have you seen that, Brock?
I did. I had a look. I didn't read it word for word, but I looked at all the pictures, which is what I love to do with National Geographic.
Yeah,
so I did
great.
I scanned it, though. It's amazing.
Yeah, this foldout shows the whole entire range, Cascade, Sierras, and shows from how the snow melt will flow down to the various rivers and then into the Central Valley, into the Delta and so forth, the San Joaquin Valley. You really get a sense of how the whole system works, and then the plumbing that goes from the northern rivers to the south, too. So it's quite a complicated picture, you might say.
It's a really complicated picture, I think. Some will say that California is the most hydrologically modified place on the planet, and if you really do exactly the anatomy of the plumbing that you were just describing, then think about how the Los Angeles aqueduct that takes water from the east side of the Sierras up by Mono Lake, or the Central Valley Project, like you said, or the California State Water Project. So we're getting water from the Klamath out of the Trinity, Shasta, and then up all of Lassen and the Feather and Sacramento and the San Joaquin, and then the Colorado is brought over, and then obviously the local mountain ranges, the San Gabriels. Everything else on the western slope of the Sierra Nevada is feeding into the systems. It's an amazing system, and yet the deal is if it doesn't rain and it doesn't snow in the system, there's not that much flexibility in it after a number of years. And that's what I think, being that we just started on October 1st, the new water year, they count water years starting on October 1st. That's really when the estimate of precipitation in the mountains might start freezing and building up the snowpack that is needed for 2015. And we're going into 2013 having been the driest year on record, and the snowpack's in, somewhere between 40% to 60% in the Sierras, and roughly 50% to 70% of California's water supply is Sierra snowmelt. And if we don't get more snow this year, it's going to be a rough go, even with all of those aqueducts and canals and reservoirs and things. So it's a tenuous system at best, because it's dependent on it working in average years. But in multiple years of drought, then it's really getting tested. And I don't think the system's ever been tested this hard since it's been built, since the last big drought was in 77.
What about the impact on wildlife? Are naturalists finding that a lot more animals are coming down into the low areas from the mountains early, say, this fall?
Yeah, the wildlife that I work on a lot with a lot of other folks, especially in the Coast Range, are the various salmonids, like coho salmon and steelhead trout or Chinook salmon, the fish. And I can tell you, just across the board, up and down, even when we aren't in drought, our rivers are significantly compromised with respect to water quantity and in-stream flows. But in the drought, we have whole reaches of streams and rivers that are just dried up and have gone away. And it's an interesting notion, the idea that fish need water. It's kind of a novel concept. And so the endangerment of these fish, California has an incredibly high number of listed threatened and endangered species, especially fisheries. So the fish issues, and it's not just the salmonids, it's others. I was reading an article recently about a number of turtles down south that they're rescuing these endangered pond turtles because the lakes are drying up. Obviously the terrestrial wildlife, the mammals and birds and reptiles and amphibians that are requiring these water holes or springs or moist areas, wetlands, there, as those systems are drying up, those animals are finding it increasingly harder to obtain the water they need, whether that's for breeding or just drinking or cover. So, and then also the vegetation, like the rangelands that you spoke of earlier, or our woodlands, our forests, the native plants are significantly drought stressed, and so they're not as healthy. There's a lot of die-off happening. There's beetle blights happening. So then the food sources and the cover sources for the animal based on the vegetation is really impacted. And then the final straw here is that in the midst of the drought, we're in the worst wildfire season. So not only is there not enough water and then the plants are stressed, but then we're having these catastrophic fires, which all of that's just a triple whammy for wildlife and human communities as well, with the wildfire season, which is an expression of drought. So it's a complicated web we've gotten ourselves into.
What are some of the most common misconceptions about water you encounter, which are important to understanding California's drought, especially in the North Bay Bay Area?
I think the primary misconception is that many people just don't understand the water cycle, and they don't have a connection or a relationship to where the water comes from, say, the tap in their home. And there's just a sense that you just turn the tap on and there's lots of water and it's just gonna come to you. And that it somehow is expensive, where that's unfortunately not the case. I think the other misconception is that a lot of people just don't recognize that we live in a Mediterranean climate. It's a dryland climate. It's an amazing climate. There's only five places on the planet that are Mediterranean, and even further south in the Southern California desert dryland systems, and that there's an imposition of an East Coast narrative and landscape aesthetic that is more accustomed to summer rains and moisture systems, and a lot of that landscape choice has been imposed upon the West, and it's absolutely inappropriate. And having big, watery, grassy lawns in the West we're not Kentucky. This isn't New York. It's not the East Coast. And I think people are going to have to rethink their entire perception of the landscape and the hydrology of the place to be more in keeping with the location versus imposing upon it because of their preconditioned notion that they live somewhere else. And if they like big lawns and things, they ought to move back east and go home or not. But so I think that there's just that general lack of understanding about where we live and our relationship to the natural world, and that there are limits in the system. And we can support those limits, but if we continue to use more water than we should, and we continue to compromise the watershed's health by mismanaging forests or rangelands or increasing stormwater runoff with too much urbanization or impervious surfaces or drainage systems and clear-cutting riparian corridors and draining wetlands, ironically, we've systematically dehydrated the wet parts of an intrinsically dry place. So we've exacerbated our scenario. So we've lost 90% of the wetlands in California, 90% of the riverine forest, the riparian corridors, due to development and agriculture and urbanization. And so we made a place that was already dry and had a few special wet spots. We've made sure we dried those up as well. So we've got to just figure out how to pattern our landscape and our settlements to be more in keeping with the natural capacity of this Mediterranean system we live in, I think.
Well, as a Northern California, I really resent all that water we're shipping down to the south. And should they really be developing down there when they don't have the water resources?
Yeah, it's a big challenge. And so then you say, well, there's 20 million or plus folks down there, and if they don't have the water, then maybe they'll I'll just move up here.
Oh, my God.
So it's a bit of a challenge when you've got a state that's 30 million, 33 million and growing, and where do we apportion people and at what density and level? And that's the urban population, ironically, interestingly, when you look at water consumption of the developed water supply in California, urban municipal metropolitan water use only accounts for somewhere between 12%, 10 to 14%, something like that, depending on how you're counting it. Industrials in there somewhere in the 10s to 20%, again, how you count it. And interestingly enough, agriculture is the dominant user of water in the state, makes sense with respect to the fact that you imagine the Central Valley being the fruit and nut basket of the planet, and the volume of agriculture in this state, it's, you can see why so much water is going to agriculture. Whether you agree with how the water is being used or what crops are being grown, that's a different question. But so I think we have to really unpack, everybody's got a consumptive part of the portfolio of the water budget we're consuming, and all of us are going to have to tighten up our ship. So the urban folks, the plow agriculture folks, the dry land agriculture vineyard folks, or the rangeland folks, we've all got to figure out how to tighten up our act appropriate to whatever our land use is.
What about the use of water by fracking? That's sort of a relatively new use of water.
Oh boy, I can't have a discussion about water anymore, not to bring on the fracking issue. I don't pretend to be an expert at all in the fracking thing, so I read what I try to catch up on in the news and other papers. It appears to me that where fracking is occurring, there is a consumptive use of the local water that by the well drillers themselves, because they need water to convey the chemicals and the things that they're hydraulically fracking with, whether it's for oil or the shale for gas. And so there's that specific consumptive use of wherever the supply of that water comes from and whoever was using it for something else. And then some of that water comes back up on the surface in a polluted form and now is on the surface and needs to be dealt with lest it becomes a problem of surface water pollution. And some of that water stays in the ground and doesn't ever come back out. And the big question there is just, what's the potential for cross-contaminating our groundwater basins with that water and the associated chemicals within it? So there's both water quantity and water quality concerns both at the surface and underground. And it's a complicated deal. In the end, as far as when I can squint at it, it would appear that the wise folks out there would probably prefer that their great-grandkids would say thank you to their 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 parents before having said no to fracking in that watershed.
How do you think the initiative from Governor Brown to start managing groundwater will affect California residents and farmers, and who else?
Yeah, so, you know, then what's this historic, sometimes people, the Pavley-Dickinson groundwater package, where there's an assembly bill, 1739, and there's two state bills, SB 1168 and 1319. And so it's a whole package of bills. But basically the gist of these are is really recognizing the criticalness of California's groundwater. There's an estimate that roughly about a third of California's water supply is groundwater, and that we have a significant number of groundwater basins in California that are in various states of overdraft, meaning more water is being taken out of them than can be sustainably infiltrated or is part of the sustained yield of that system based on however it works with rainfall or snowmelt. And so, in essence, what these bills are doing is creating, basically suggesting that the Department of Water Resources is going to have to identify the various groundwater basins in the state and then rank them as to their state of overdraft. And the ones that are in a high state or medium state are going to be required, in essence, to take a definition of sustainable groundwater management, if you will, and create or require existing local agencies or make new ones if they don't exist to adopt management plans for these groundwater basins and then go through processes with those management plans to ultimately bring the utilization of that water in the groundwater basin into a state of sustainability, if you will. So there's a set, I think, ultimately it's required that by 2017, these local groundwater management agencies need to be identified, and then by 2020 you have to have sustainability plans for overdrafted groundwater basins, and then by 2040 all high and medium priority groundwater basins have to, quote, achieve sustainability. And there's triggers that throughout, you know, milestones that say, well, if you haven't achieved this, then you got to do better or the state's going to come in. And so it's a, you know, it's hallelujah, because California has been the last state in the union to not have mandated groundwater management plans. All the other states have been on this. Even Texas is ahead of us here.
Wow.
So now we're finally the United States of America with respect to groundwater management. But this is a long-term thing. So, you know, it's 2014, and so we're talking about these high and medium basins needing to achieve sustainability by 2040. So between here and there is a lot of hope. It's a lot of opportunity, actually, I think, for local communities to participate, to talk about land use, to talk about groundwater, which means you get to talk about surface water, and really thinking like a watershed, so that groundwater is, surface water and groundwater are a single resource. They're not separate. And the only way something was became groundwater is at some point it had to have been a surface water that came from a cloud, that ultimately came from the ocean. And so coming up with sustained yields within watersheds and surfaces above ground that through land use can either increase the ability to infiltrate water into the ground by design or decrease it, such as paving, piping, and polluting. So we've got, it ultimately, for agriculture and for urbanization, for all land use settlement within any basin, we have the opportunity to rethink and reevaluate how it is we do land use to be retentive of water, to recharge water, to move forward what I call slow it, spread it, sink it, as part of managing the groundwater, which is just a piggy bank of water, because by reconnecting it from the surface water. And so it's, I'm happy that this has happened. It's better late than never kind of deal. But as Tip O'Neill used to say, right, all politics are local. Well, all water politics are really local, and groundwater politics are uber local. And so this is going to get, hopefully, local folks need to be aware and pay attention and get on your local groundwater planning agencies and participate in your water democracy in your community on behalf of your local system to determine what gets to happen where with respect to how it impacts the quantity and quality of water in a sustainable way that's balanced to the budget of your annual income that you get from the sky in the form of fog or rain or snow or any combination thereof.
You're listening to KWMR, Community Radio for West Marin, 90.5 FM, Point Reyes Station, 89.9 FM Bolinas, and 92.3 FM San Geronimo Valley, and streaming live at kwmr.org. Now back to our interview with Brock Dolman. And my co-host was my wife, Eleanor Despina. So here we go back to Brock.
No, I was just in New York City for the People's Climate March.
Hallelujah, good for you.
Yeah. When one thing I've been thinking about is how we live in a bubble here in California. At least we have in the past. We don't really realize the urgency of what's happening to our climate, but maybe this drought is really going to wake up a lot of people and get them engaged.
Well, to the degree, the challenge, I totally support the aspiration here. I think the interesting piece is then how, first of all, do people understand how the planet works, and then the relationship of combusting fossil fuels and thickening the atmosphere such that it increases the intensity of the greenhouse effect by retaining more heat, which results in this idea of a greenhouse effect leading to global warming, and therefore climates must change. So those are sequential relationships. Climate change and global warming aren't exchangeable synonyms. They're different expressions of process, if you will. And so if, in fact, the greenhouse effect is amplifying, what's interesting is if you believe you live on planet water, anyone who understands enough about physics realizes that air can only take so much heat, so much energy. And when we look at the amount of energy coming into the planet that's being retained because of this thickening blanket of greenhouse gases that are warming the planet from anthropogenic combustion of coal, oil, and gas, fossil fuels, or fossil fuels, take your pick. What's interesting is that, again, 70% of the surface area of this planet is ocean. And so the heat, for the most part, roughly the estimate is about 1% of the heat is going to heat up the air, and then 3% heating up the ice, and another 3% or so, a little more, is heating up the land. And the rest of the heat budget that's being retained, where is it going? Oh, it's going into the oceans, because that's the biggest battery, thermal battery, that can absorb this extra heat. So if you heard the climate deniers talk about a slowing of climate, global warming, because average air temperatures haven't been increasing as fast as they were 20 years prior, it's mostly because what's being, a few studies have recently been published, are trying to really reckon with the fact that the air is somewhat maxed out, and now where that heat, the increase in the retention of the heat is being dumped into the oceans, and now the temperature of the world's oceans and the surface of the oceans especially has been shown to be dramatically increasing, and also the CO2 turns into carbonic acid and creates in acidification of the ocean. The oceans are about 25% more acidic than they were at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So now if you get warm oceans, then you get things like the typhoon that this past week was going across the Pacific below Okinawa, Bong Fong, that had wind speeds of up in 180 miles, 190 miles an hour. Only last year, a typhoon Haiyan that hit the Philippines at 195 mile an hour winds. It's the fastest wind speed we've ever recorded in modern recorded history. And that's because if you've got a hot ocean, you can move more energy. But if you've melted more ice in the Arctic, and now it's warmer in the Arctic, so the difference between Arctic temperature and the temperature of the equator is a little bit less, then this big atmospheric river of air and moisture called the jet stream, that this counterclockwise jet stream, appears to be slowing down based on a number of studies, which appears to get that river meandering, like all rivers that slow down meander. So then we get a high pressure in the eastern Pacific that pushes the jet stream up over this big rock, and they didn't even have the Iditarod sled race in Alaska this year because it was too warm this winter.
Wow.
California's in drought, and Atlanta got pummeled by the polar vortex, and they were freezing. And all of those conflated relationships have to do with physics and temperature as a result of what is called global warming and climate change. So California's drought, it appears, is going to be linked back to anthropogenic combustion of carbon.
Tell us a little bit more about the physics. I understand there's the high pressure keeping the normal rainfall away from California. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, and I'm just, again, as a layperson, trying to read the scientific literature and understand these papers, and you know, science is ever changing, getting more data. But I'm conflating a series of, narratives happening out there, but what it looks like, and this woman Jennifer Francis would be the papers to study on their thesis about the impact of the jet stream, is that it appears that to the degree that the eastern Pacific, where we live, is that ocean temps are, there's a relationship between the ocean temps and creating a high pressure cell over the eastern Pacific, and that high pressure cell appears to be pushing the jet stream more northerly in a way and bringing the warmer temperatures up, but it kind of acts like a rock in a stream, if you will, and it almost appears at times, like this last winter with the polar vortex, that jet stream of air bounced off this rock and then came down over the top of it like a waterfall and was able to bring that blast of cold air all the way down to Atlanta, which was called this past year the polar vortex. And so thinking about the jet stream as a meandering belt of air and temperature and moisture, and you have high and low pressures, and so to the degree that a warming Arctic means there's a gradient between the warmer tropics and supposedly typically colder Arctic is decreased, it allows that atmospheric river of air to meander more widely, and that therefore those meanders are able to either move more heat more northerly or bring more cold more southerly, depending on where you are on the planet. And these are, you know, folks are just really beginning to understand this and get more data on it, but conceptually the physics of it don't appear to be that complicated, right?
For that explanation. We're going to have to wrap it up in a bit, but I wanted to ask you, what other main points or lessons from your own work you'd like to pass along to our listeners concerning the drought, its causes, its impacts, and what we can do about it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my sense is that people take it personally, and that means really starting with yourself and your home and your family and your community and saying, okay, how can I get my water footprint, my water budget to be the smallest on the demand side as I can, i.e. conservation. So I look inside my house and I figure out every water consuming device in the house, my shower, my bathroom, sink, my bathtub, my laundry system, and my washer. And I basically figure out how can I have the lowest flow device possible in gallons per minute, low flow shower heads or low flow toilets, and horizontal washers that use 12 gallons a load versus upright washers that use 25 or 40 gallons a load. And so we tighten that budget up, and then we choose not to use whenever possible. We just get as conservative as we can. And then we figure out any water that can be a gray water. So we think about laundry, showers, bathroom sinks. Legally in California, we can take laundry out to your landscape if you follow a simple 10 set of guidelines without a permit, and we can design a system to reuse that laundry water in our landscape for irrigation and get, like I said before, twice as much bang for our buck on that 1 gallon. Then we can also use our shower and bathroom in a different kind of gray water system and have that for outdoor irrigation. Then we go outside, which might be 50% of our demand, and we say, how can we recontour our landscape in a way, if appropriate, based on soils and slope, that we can catch that surface runoff from the hardscapes, the patios, the driveways, and possibly bring it into our landscape and infiltrate it into the ground, and then plant a vegetation community that could be natives and some edible perennials, woody perennials, that will be, we plant the water at their roots and then the plants grow, and they're being dry farmed because we're strategically irrigating them with winter stormwater runoff in place. And we could move our landscape over to an almost entirely rain-fed based system by stormwater harvesting, which reduces the total volume of runoff and mitigates flooding in the winter, reduces water demand in the summer by having a landscape that's adapted to this, and we can also supplement with gray water on site, and we don't need to send all that gray water to the treatment plant, which just saves electricity and the need for the folks there at the treatment plant to treat all that water. And then we could also look at our roof as an above ground well, like you all were talking about your chicken coop, and on 1,000 square feet of roof with an inch of rain, we get 550 gallons, and we can either put that in the ground or store some of it in a tank and think about how we could live on that high-quality roof water. We treat it with some carbon filtration UV light to make sure it was potable. And we could probably actually conceive of a quarter-acre, half-acre suburban lot with a family of 2 to 4 actually living off of the amount of rain in a 24-inch year, which is average for the Bay Area, from all the rain that fell on their entire home. And we might not even need to ask of water from the big pipe or use any of that water, only supplement a little bit of that water. And there's, imagine a world where we stopped defecating in water entirely, and we actually defecated in the carbon cycle and not the water cycle through compost toilets. These are all doable. We can protect public health and safety this way. It's more affordable, and it uses less energy because there's the water energy nexus out there where every gallon of water you use has an associated number of kilowatt hours of electricity that it was required to pump it and treat it and bring it to you, and then if you make it into wastewater, make it go away. And we have to reduce our carbon footprint by reducing our use of energy to get the greenhouse gas emissions down. So saving water saves energy and can reduce our carbon impact by reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So I'm interested in people thinking holistically at their home scale, and then their neighborhood scale, and their city scale, and their community scale, and ultimately thinking like a watershed from ridgeline to river mouth. You retrofit for resilience, all human settlement, to live in conformance with the water budget that Gaia gives you on an annual basis.
Wow.
Fantastic.
That's a great.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You, Brock, it sounds so great. Brock, before you go, I want to thank you so much for joining us on Post Carbon Radio. We're speaking to Brock Doman of the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center, and he is, what is your title with the Water Institute?
Oh, I'm one of the program directors for the Water Institute.
I see. And could you give us a couple of websites where people could get more information about what your work?
Yeah, you can just go to www.oaecwater.org, and that's the Water Institute's website. And then also the Oxford Arts and Ecology Center's website is just oaec.org, and that gives you a sense of our other programs and things like that as well.
Well, thank you once again for being with us. Hope to see you soon.
Always a pleasure being in Eleanor. Nice to chat with you.
That was a wonderful interview. I think Brock is such an interesting person. And I think in connection with that, listeners may be interested in hearing about a workshop that CLAM is putting on Saturday, October 25th. It's a rainwater harvesting workshop, and it's going to be at the Dance Palace from 3 p.m. to 5:30, and you can get more information about it by calling Ruth at the CLAM office, which is 663-1005. I think it will be really interesting. We have a rainwater harvesting expert coming in to teach us about how to harvest gray water and rainwater.
I see it's $20 for CLAM members and $25 for non-members. Purchase tickets at the CLAM office, I guess.
Yeah, I think the best thing is to call Ruth at 663-1005.
Now we're going to talk to Chelsea Tu, a staff attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, who works on limiting land development and preserving freshwater resources for the public and endangered species. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Chelsea.
Thank you, Bing. It's such a pleasure to be on.
Tell us a little bit about the Center for Biological Diversity.
Sure. The Center for Biological Diversity is a 25-year-old national environmental nonprofit organization. We are a group of very passionate scientists, policy professionals, and lawyers that work to protect endangered species and wild places.
Great. And what is your position and focus at the Center for Biological Diversity?
Well, I'm a staff attorney with the Urban Wildlands Program at the Center for Biological Diversity, and my main role at the center focuses on securing water supply for local communities and sensitive ecosystems in California, as well as stopping destructive water infrastructure projects that would only benefit big agricultural interests.
Well, I met Chelsea on the People's Climate Train when we went to New York City for the People's Climate March, and I heard Chelsea give a presentation on the train on water security and Proposition 1 that's going to be on the California ballot on November 4th. So tell us, give us some background on Proposition 1 and what the center position is on it.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So Proposition 1, in other words, the water bond, will appear first on the ballot this November when you go out to vote. And it's extremely important because it provides $7.5 billion of taxpayer money that would fund water supply projects throughout the state. The center is opposing the water bond or Proposition 1 because 36% of the $7.5 billion, or about $2.7 billion of the bond, would actually go towards additional water storage projects, and this means big dams. The center is opposed to building big dams because they're very destructive for the environment, and the center also views the bond as California's water investments turned upside down, in that the bond provides so much money for old 19th century solutions that don't do anything, add water to help us in a drought situation, but the bond also deprioritizes and really undermines solutions that we really need, including conservation, efficiency, and recycling.
Well, who are the proponents of Proposition 1?
Some of the main proponents of Proposition 1 are those that will benefit the most if the proposition goes through, and this include big agricultural interests, including California Western Growers Association, the California Farm Bureau Federation, and they are also the biggest donors of the Yes on Prop 1 campaign. So it's evident that those who benefit are going to be the biggest supporters and funders of this proposition.
I see that there is a newspaper article in this week's Point Reyes Light on the California water bond, and it states here that the article was by Samantha Kimney and Doug Obigi, a staff attorney for the National Resource Defense Council, has argued at the Marin Conservation League breakfast last week that Californians should vote for Proposition 1 because the major investments for the bond provides for watershed restoration, water recycling, habitat restoration, and clean drinking water, to which over a million state residents don't have access. How do you respond to that, Chelsea?
While we are supportive of some of the beneficial provisions of the bond, the center really looks at the bond as a package that embodies California's potential of rethinking its water system. And we think that this is a bad investment because even though there are small nuggets in the bond that would provide drinking water for rural communities or restore some ecosystems, the big picture is that the bad portions of the bond really overwhelmingly outweigh the good. And so while some environmental organizations support the bond, they really only focus on the tiny benefits that the proposition might bring, but ignore the terrible consequences, including environmental consequences, that would result if the bond passes, from building dams, for example. And Californians really shouldn't be forced to swallow a poison pill that's sugar-coated. Instead, it should, like Brock was saying, really critically evaluate what's inside the bond, who is it going to benefit, And I think at this important juncture, how do we restructure our hydrological system so that we are well prepared not only to solve this drought but for future droughts? And those innovative proven strategies like conservation, efficiency, and recycling are simply not there in this bond, and they should be prioritized in an investment as important as this one.
You also say that you wanted to point out that $2.7 billion for additional water storage would be continuously appropriated, which means it will go straight to specific projects the Water Commission chooses. However, the $1.5 billion for conservation, efficiency, recycling, etc., will still need to be appropriated by the legislature, which presents another hurdle to implementing these solutions. You want to comment more?
Exactly. So this is where the devil really is in the details, and I urge everybody to read through the bond or a fair analysis of the bond to find that the language inside the bond strongly favors additional water storage and almost compels the Water Commission, a 9-people governor-appointed board, to say yes on dams and yes on big infrastructure projects that are hugely detrimental to the environment. And one of the devils in the detail is how this money will be allocated to different purposes. So the $2.7 billion, like you said, would be continuously appropriated. So once the Water Commission decides on a project, the money will be automatically funneled to the project. Right now, there are already 3 reservoirs and dams that are being reviewed by different agencies that have been in line for many years, and they will be the first to claim that money once the commission, because the political system favors so much towards Big Ag, decides on building more dams. On the other hand, as you pointed out, some of them proven innovative long-term solutions that we've talked about, conservation, efficiency, and recycling, have to go through so many hoops, including competing under competitive grant programs, and that would still have to go through the hurdle of being appropriated by the legislature if it chooses to, in order to be implemented. And I just wanted to point out, within that $1.5 billion that would go towards long-term solutions that the center would like to see and California really needs to invest in, of that $1.5 billion, $810 million are specifically designated for conservation, efficiency, stormwater capture, and other proven long-term solutions. But the language also says that only $100 million may be allocated towards conservation. As we heard earlier, conservation, whether at a personal level or at the local or state level, is really the first step that we need to take and really the first investment that we need to make in order to make do with our limited water budget in a drier and drier climate.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up. Chelsea, do you have any... Oh, maybe tell us where people can go to your website and find out more about these water issues.
Sure. So our website is www.biologicaldiversity.org. And under the Urban Wildlands Program, you can go to the water supply page, which will have 3 points on the center's position in opposition of the water bond. And you can also go to the top right and go to the Google custom search bar and search water supply for more information.
Thank you, Chelsea, to staff attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity, for joining us on Post Carbon Radio today.
Thank you very much.
You can listen to this and other archived podcasts of our program on wmpostcarbon.com.